The next night, four of them met and called me in. We discussed the story all night long. Lee laughed. I guess it's funny, he said. I know I wouldn't dare tell it to many people. Can you imagine four old gentlemen, the youngest is over 90 now, taking on the study of Hebrew? They engaged a learned rabbi. They took to the study as though they were children. Exercise books, grammar, vocabulary, simple sentences. You should see Hebrew written in Chinese ink with a brush. The right to left didn't bother them as much as it would you, since we write up to down. Oh, they were perfectionists. They went to the root of the matter.
And you? Said Samuel.
I went along with them, marveling at the beauty of their proud, clean brains. I began to love my race, and for the first time I wanted to be Chinese. Every 2 weeks I went to a meeting with them, and in my room here I covered pages with writing. I bought every known Hebrew dictionary, but the old gentlemen were always ahead of me. It wasn't long before they were ahead of our rabbi. He brought a colleague in. Mr. Hamilton, you should have sat through some of those nights of argument and discussion. The questions, the inspection. Oh, the lovely thinking, the beautiful thinking. After 2 years, we felt that we could approach your 16 verses of the fourth chapter of Genesis. My old gentleman felt that these words were very important too. Thou shalt and do thou. And this was the gold from our mining. Thou mayest. Thou mayest rule over sin. The old gentleman smiled and nodded and felt the years were well spent. It brought them out of their Chinese shells, too, and right now they are studying Greek. Samuel said, It's a fantastic story. And I've tried to follow, and maybe I've missed somewhere. Why is that word so important? Lee's hand shook as he filled the delicate cups. He drank his down in one gulp. Don't you see? He cried. The American Standard Translation orders men to triumph over sin, and you can call sin ignorance. The King James Translation makes a promise in thou shalt, meaning that men will surely triumph over sin. But the Hebrew word, the word timshul, thou mayest, that gives a choice. It might be the most important word in the world. That says the way is open. That throws it right back on a man. For if thou mayest, it is also true that thou mayest not. Don't you see?
Yes, I see. I do see. But you don't believe this is divine law. Why do you feel its importance?
Ah, said Lee, I've wanted to tell you this for a long time. I even anticipated your questions, and I'm well prepared. Any writing which has influenced the thinking and the lives of innumerable people is important. Now, there are many millions in their sects and churches who feel the order, do thou, and throw their weight into obedience. And there are millions more who feel predestination in thou shalt. Nothing they may do can interfere with what will be. But thou mayest. Why, that makes a man great. That gives him stature with the gods. For in his weakness and his filth and his murder of his brother, he has still the great choice. He can choose his course and fight it through and win.
Lee's voice was a chant of triumph. Adam said, Do you believe that, Lee?
Yes, I do. Yes, I do. It is easy out of laziness, out of weakness, to throw oneself into the lap of deity, saying, I couldn't help it. The way was set. But think of the glory of the choice. That makes a man a man. A cat has no choice. A bee must make honey. There's no godliness there. And do you know, those old gentlemen who were sliding gently down to death are too interested to die now.
Adam said, Do you mean these Chinese men believe the Old Testament?
Lee said, These old men believe a true story. And they know a true story when they hear it. They are critics of truth.
They know that these 16 verses are a history of humankind in any age or culture or race. They don't believe a man writes 15 3/4 verses of truth and tells a lie with one verb. Confucius tells men how they should live to have good and successful lives. But this is a ladder to climb to the stars. Li's eyes shone. You can never lose that. It cuts the feet from under weakness and cowardliness and laziness. Adam said, I don't see how you could cook and raise the boys and take care of me and still do all this. Neither do I, said Li. But I take my 2 pipes in the afternoon, no more and no less, like the elders. And I feel that I am a man. And I feel that a man is a very important thing, maybe more important than a star. This is not theology. I have no bent toward gods. But I have a new love for that glittering instrument, the human soul. It is a lovely and unique thing in the universe. It is always attacked and never destroyed, because thou mayest. Li and Adam walked out to the shed with Samuel to see him off. Li carried a tin lantern to light the way, for it was one of those clear, early winter nights when the sky riots with stars and the earth seems doubly dark because of them. A silence lay on the hills. No animal moved about, neither grass-eater nor predator, and the air was so still that the dark limbs and leaves of the live oaks stood unmoving against the Milky Way. The 3 men were silent. The bale of the tin lantern squeaked a little as the light swung in Lee's hand. Adam asked, When do you think you'll be back from your trip? Samuel didn't answer. Doxology stood patiently in the stall, head down, his milky eyes staring at the straw under his feet. You've had that horse forever, Adam said. He's 33, said Samuel. His teeth are worn off. I have to feed him warm mash with my fingers, and he has bad dreams. He shivers and cries sometimes in his sleep. He's about as ugly a crowbait as I ever saw, Adam said. I know it. I think that's why I picked him when he was a colt. You know, I paid $2 for him 33 years ago. Everything was wrong with him. Hoofs like flapjacks, a hock so thick and short and straight there seems no joint at all. He's hammer-headed and sway-backed. He has a pinched chest and a big behind. He has an iron mouth, and he still fights the crupper. With a saddle, he feels as though you were riding a sled over a gravel pit. He can't trot, and he stumbles over his feet when he walks. I have never, in 33 years, found one good thing about him. He even has an ugly disposition. He's selfish and quarrelsome and mean and disobedient. To this day, I don't dare walk behind him because he will surely take a kick at me. When I feed him mash, he tries to bite my hand. And I love him. Li said, And you named him Doxology. Surely, said Samuel, so ill-endowed a creature deserved, I thought, one grand possession. He hasn't very long now. Adam said, Maybe you should put him out of his misery. What misery? Samuel demanded. He's one of the few happy and consistent beings I've ever met. He must have aches and pains. Well, he doesn't think so. Doxology still thinks he's one hell of a horse. Would you shoot him, Adam? Yes, I think I would. Yes, I would. You'd take the responsibility? Yes, I think I would. He's 33. His lifespan is long over. Li had set his lantern on the ground. Samuel squatted beside it and instinctively stretched his hands for warmth to the butterfly of yellow light. I've been bothered by something, Adam, he said. What is that? You would really shoot my horse because death might be more comfortable? Well, I meant, Samuel said quickly. Do you like your life, Adam? Of course not. If I had a medicine that might cure you, but also might kill you, should I give it to you? Inspect yourself, man. What medicine? No, said Samuel. If I tell you, believe me when I say it may kill you.
Lee said, Be careful, Mr. Hamilton, be careful.
What is this? Adam demanded. Tell me what you're thinking of.
Samuel said softly,
I think for once I will not be careful. Lee, if I am wrong, listen, if I am mistaken, I accept the responsibility and I will take what blame there is to take.
Are you sure you're right? Lee asked anxiously.
Of course I'm not sure. Adam, do you want the medicine?
Yes. I don't know what it is, but give it to me.
Adam, Kathy is in Salinas. She owns a whorehouse. The most vicious and depraved in this whole end of the country. The evil and ugly, the distorted and slimy, the worst things human can think up are for sale there. The crippled and crooked come there for satisfaction. But it's worse than that. Kathy, she's now called Kate, takes the fresh and young and beautiful and so maims them that they can never be whole again. Now, there's your medicine. Let's see what it does to you.
You're a liar, Adam said.
No, Adam. Many things I am, but a liar I am not. Adam whirled on Lee.
Is this true?
I'm no antidote, said Lee. Yes, it's true. Adam stood swaying in the lantern light, and then he turned and ran. They could hear his heavy steps running and tripping. They heard him falling over the brush and scrambling and clawing his way upward on the slope. The sound of him stopped only when he had gone over the brow of the hill. Lee said, Your medicine acts like poison.
I take responsibility, said Samuel.
Long ago I learned this. When a dog has eaten strychnine and is going to die, you must get an axe and carry him to a chopping block. Then you must wait for his next convulsion, and in that moment, chop off his tail. Then, if the poison hasn't gone too far, your dog may recover. The shock of pain may counteract the poison. Without the shock, he will surely die.
But how do you know this is the same? Lee asked.
I don't. But without it, he would surely die.
You're a brave man, Lee said.
No, I'm an old man. And if I should have anything on my conscience, it won't be for long.
Lee asked, What do you suppose he'll do?
I don't know, said Samuel. But at least he won't sit around and mope. Here, hold the lantern for me, will you?
In the yellow light, Samuel slipped the bit in Doxology's mouth, a bit worn so thin that it was a flake of steel. The check rein had been abandoned long ago. The old hammerhead was free to drag his nose if he wished, or to pause and crop grass beside the road. Samuel didn't care. Tenderly, he buckled the crupper, and the horse edged around to try to kick him. When Dox was between the shafts of the cart, Lee asked,
Would you mind if I rode along with you a little? I'll walk back.
Come along, said Samuel. And he tried not to notice that Lee helped him up into the cart.
The night was very dark, and Dox showed his disgust for night traveling by stumbling every few steps.
Samuel said, Get on with it, Lee. What is it you want to say?
Lee didn't appear surprised. Maybe I'm nosy the way you say you are. I get to thinking. I know probabilities, but tonight you fooled me completely. I would have taken any bet that you, of all men, would not have told Adam.
Did you know about her?
Of course, said Lee.
Do the boys know?
I don't think so. But that's only a matter of time. You know how cruel children are. Someday in the schoolyard it will be shouted at them.
Maybe he ought to take them away from here, said Samuel.
Think about that, Lee. My question isn't answered, Mr. Hamilton. How were you able to do what you did?
Do you think I was that wrong?
No, I don't mean that at all. But I've never thought of you as taking any strong, unchanging stand on anything. This has been my judgment. Are you interested?
Show me the man who isn't interested in discussing himself, said Samuel. Go on.
You're a kind man, Mr. Hamilton. And I've always thought it was the kindness that comes from not wanting any trouble. And your mind is as facile as a young lamb leaping in a daisy field. You have never, to my knowledge, taken a bulldog grip on anything. And then tonight, you did a thing that tears down my whole picture of you.
Samuel wrapped the lines around a stick stuck in the whip socket, and Doxology stumbled on down the ruddy road. The old man stroked his beard, and it shone very white in the starlight. He took off his black hat and laid it in his lap.
"I guess it surprised me as much as it did you," he said. "But if you want to know why, look into yourself."
"I don't understand you."
"If you had only told me about your studies earlier, it might have made a great difference, Lee."
"I still don't understand you."
"Careful, Lee, you'll get me talking. I told you my Irish came and went. It's coming now."
Lee said, "Mr. Hamilton, you're going away, and you're not coming back. You don't intend to live very much longer."
"That's true, Lee. How did you know?"
"This death all around you. It shines from you."
"I didn't know anyone could see it," Samuel said. "You know, Lee, I think of my life as a kind of music. Not always good music, but still having form and melody. And my life hasn't been a full orchestra for a long time now. A single note only, and that note unchanging sorrow. I'm not alone in my attitude, Lee. It seems to me that too many of us conceive of a life as ending in defeat."
Lee said, "Maybe everyone is too rich. I have noticed that there is no dissatisfaction like that of the rich. Feed a man, clothe him, put him in a good house, and he will die of despair."
"It was your two-word retranslation, Lee. Thou mayest. It took me by the throat and shook me. And when the dizziness was over, a path was open, new and bright. And my life, which is ending, seems to be going on to an ending wonderful. And my music has a new, last melody, like a bird song in the night."
Lee was peering at him through the darkness.
"That's what it did to those old men of my family."
"Thou mayest rule over sin, Lee. That's it. I don't believe all men are destroyed. I can name you a dozen who weren't, and they are the ones the world lives by. It is true of the spirit as it is true of battles. Only the winners are remembered. Surely most men are destroyed, but there are others who, like pillars of fire, guide frightened men through the darkness. Thou mayest. Thou mayest. What glory! It is true that we are weak and sick and quarrelsome. But if that is all we ever were, we would, millenniums ago, have disappeared from the face of the earth. A few remnants of fossilized jawbones, some broken teeth and strata of limestone, would be the only mark man would have left of his existence in the world. But the choice, Lee, the choice of winning. I have never understood it or accepted it before. Do you see now why I told Adam tonight? I exercised the choice. Maybe I was wrong, but by telling him, I also forced him to live or get off the pot. What is that word, Lee?"
"Timshul," said Lee. "Will you stop the cart?"
"You'll have a long walk back."
Lee climbed down.
"Samuel," he said.
"Here am I." The old man chuckled. "Liza hates for me to say that."
"Samuel, you've gone beyond me."
"It's time, Lee."
"Goodbye, Samuel,"
Lee said, and he walked hurriedly back along the road. He heard the iron tires of the cart grinding on the road. He turned and looked after it. And on the slope he saw old Samuel against the sky, his white hair shining with starlight.
Chapter 25. It was a deluge of a winter in the Salinas Valley.
wet and wonderful. The rains fell gently and soaked in and did not fresh it. The feed was deep in January, and in February the hills were fat with grass, and the coats of the cattle looked tight and sleek. In March the soft rains continued, and each storm waited courteously until its predecessors sank beneath the ground. Then warmth flooded the valley, and the earth burst into bloom, yellow and blue and gold. Tom was alone on the ranch, and even that dust heap was rich and lovely, and the flints were hidden in grass, and the Hamilton cows were fat, and the Hamilton sheep sprouted grass from their damp backs. At noon on March 15th, Tom sat on the bench outside the forge. The sunny morning was over, and gray water-bearing clouds sailed in over the mountains from the ocean, and their shadows slid under them on the bright earth. Tom heard a horse's clattering hoofs, and he saw a small boy, elbows flapping, urging a tired horse toward the house. He stood up and walked toward the road. The boy galloped up to the house, yanked off his hat, flung a yellow envelope on the ground, spun his horse around, and kicked up a gallop again. Tom started to call after him, and then he leaned wearily down and picked up the telegram. He sat in the sun on the bench outside the forge, holding the telegram in his hand, and he looked at the hills and at the old house, as though to save something, before he tore open the envelope and read the inevitable four words, the person, the event, and the time. Tom slowly folded the telegram and folded it again and again, until it was a square no larger than his thumb. He walked to the house, through the kitchen, through the little living room, and into his bedroom. He took his dark suit out of the clothes press and laid it over the back of a chair, and he put a white shirt and a black tie on the seat of the chair. And then he lay down on the bed and turned his face to the wall. The Surreys and the buggies had driven out of the Salinas Cemetery. The family and friends went back to Olive's house on Central Avenue to eat and to drink coffee, to see how each one was taking it, and to do and say the decent things. George offered Adam Trask a lift in his rented Surrey, but Adam refused. He wandered around the cemetery and sat down on the cement curb of the Williams family plot. The traditional dark cypresses wept around the edge of the cemetery, and white violets ran wild in the pathways. Someone had brought them in, and they had become weeds. The cold wind blew over the tombstones and cried in the cypresses. There were many cast-iron stars, marking the graves of Grand Army men, and on each star a small wind-bitten flag from a year ago Decoration Day. Adam sat looking at the mountains to the east of Salinas, with the noble point of Fremont's Peak dominating. The air was crystalline, as it sometimes is when rain is coming. And then the light rain began to blow on the wind, although the sky was not properly covered with cloud. Adam had come up on the morning train. He hadn't intended to come at all, but something drew him beyond his power to resist. For one thing, he couldn't believe that Samuel was dead. He could hear the rich lyric voice in his ears, the tones rising and falling in their foreignness, and the curious music of oddly chosen words tripping out so that you were never sure what the next word would be. In the speech of most men, you are absolutely sure what the next word will be. Adam had looked at Samuel in his casket and knew that he didn't want him to be dead. And since the face in the casket didn't look like Samuel's face, Adam walked away to be by himself and to preserve the man alive. He had to go to the cemetery. Custom would have been outraged else, but he stood well back where he couldn't hear the words. And when the suns filled in the grave, he had walked away and strolled in the paths where the white violets grew. The cemetery was deserted, and the dark crooning of the wind bowed the heavy cypress trees. The rain droplets grew larger and drove stinging along. Adam stood up, shivered, and walked slowly over the white violets and past the new grave. The flowers had been laid evenly to cover the mound of new-turned damp earth, and already the wind had frayed the blossoms and flung the smaller bouquets out into the path. Adam picked them up and laid them back on the mound. He walked out of the cemetery. The wind and the rain were at his back, and he ignored the wetness that soaked through his black coat. Romy Lane was muddy with pools of water standing in the new wheel ruts, and the tall wild oats and mustard grew beside the road, with wild turnip forcing its boisterous way up, and stickery beads of purple thistles rising above the green riot of the wet spring. The black dobe mud covered Adam's shoes and splashed the bottom of his dark trousers. It was nearly a mile to the Monterey Road. Adam was dirty and soaking when he reached it and turned east into the town of Salinas. The water was standing in the curved brim of his derby hat, and his collar was wet and sagging. At John Street, the road angled and became Main Street. Adam stamped the mud off his shoes when he reached the pavement. The buildings cut the wind from him, and almost instantly he began to shake with a chill. He increased his speed. Near the other end of Main Street, he turned into the Abbott House Bar. He ordered brandy and drank it quickly, and his shivering increased. Mr. LaPierre, behind the bar, saw the chill. "You'd better have another one," he said. "You'll get a bad cold. Would you like a hot rum? That'll knock it out of you." "Yes, I would," said Adam. "Well, here, you sip another cognac while I get some hot water." Adam took his glass to a table and sat uncomfortably in his wet clothes. Mr. LaPierre brought a steaming kettle from the kitchen. He put the squat glass on a tray and brought it to the table. "Drink it as hot as you can stand it," he said. "That'll shake the chill out of an aspen." He drew a chair up, sat down, then stood up. "You've made me cold," he said. "I'm going to have one myself." He brought his glass back to the table and sat across from Adam. "It's working," he said. "You were so pale you scared me when you came in." "You're a stranger?"
"I'm from near King City," Adam said.
"Come up for the funeral?"
"Yes. He was an old friend."
"Big funeral?"
"Oh, yes."
"I'm not surprised. He had lots of friends. Too bad it couldn't have been a nice day. You ought to have one more and then go to bed."
"I will," said Adam. "It makes me comfortable and peaceful."
"That's worth something. Might have saved you from pneumonia, too."
After he had served another toddy, he brought a damp cloth from behind the bar.
"You can wipe off some of that mud," he said. "A funeral isn't very gay, but when it gets rained on, that's really mournful."
"It didn't rain till after," said Adam.
"It was walking back I got wet." "Why don't you get a nice room right here? You get into bed and I'll send a toddy up to you, and in the morning you'll be fine."
"I think I'll do that," said Adam.
He could feel the blood stinging his cheeks and running hotly in his arms, as though it was some foreign warm fluid taking over his body. Then the warmth melted through into the cold, concealed box where he stored forbidden thoughts, and the thoughts came timidly up to the surface like children who don't know whether they will be received. Adam picked up the damp cloth and leaned down to sponge off the bottoms of his trousers. The blood pounded behind his eyes.
"I might have one more toddy," he said.
Mr. LaPierre said, "If it's for cold, you've had enough. But if you just want a drink, I've got some old Jamaica rum. I'd rather you'd have that straight. It's 50 years old. The water would kill the flavor."
"I just want a drink," said Adam.
"I'll have one with you. I haven't opened that jug in months. Not much call for it. This is a whiskey drink in town."
Adam wiped off his shoes and dropped the cloth on the floor. He took a drink of the dark rum and coughed. The heavy-muscled drink wrapped its sweet aroma around his head and struck at the base of his nose like a blow. The room seemed to tip sideways and then right itself.
"Good, isn't it?" Mr. LaPierre asked. "But it can knock you over. I wouldn't have more than one, unless, of course, you want to get knocked over. Some do."
Adam leaned his elbows on the table. He felt a garrulousness coming on him, and he was frightened at the impulse. His voice didn't sound like his voice, and his words amazed him.
"I don't get up here much," he said. Do you know a place called Kate's?
Jesus, that rum is better than I thought, Mr. LaPierre said. And he went on sternly. You live on a ranch?
Yes. I got a place near King City. My name's Trask.
Glad to meet you. Married?
No, not now.
Widower?
Yes.
You go to Jenny's. Let Kate alone. That's not good for you. Jenny's is right next door. You go there and you'll get everything you need.
Right next door?
Sure. You go east a block and a half and turn right. Anybody will tell you where the line is.
Adam's tongue was getting thick.
What's the matter with Kate's?
You go to Jenny's, said Mr. LaPierre.
It was a dirty, gusty evening. Castroville Street was deep in sticky mud, and Chinatown was so flooded that its inhabitants had laid planks across the narrow street that separated their hutches. The clouds against the evening sky were the gray of rats, and the air wasn't damp, but dank. I guess the difference is that dampness comes down, but dankness rises up out of rot and fermentation. The afternoon wind had dropped away and left the air raw and wounded. It was cold enough to shake out the curtains of rum in Adam's head without restoring his timidity. He walked quickly down the unpaved sidewalks, his eyes on the ground to avoid stepping in puddles. The row was dimly lit by the warning lantern where the railroad crossed the street and by one small carbon-filamented globe that burned on the porch of Jenny's. Adam had his instructions. He counted two houses and nearly missed the third, so high and unbridled were the dark bushes in front of it. He looked in through the gateway at the dark porch, slowly opened the gate, and went up the overgrown path. In the half-darkness, he could see the sagging, dilapidated porch and the shaky steps. The paint had long disappeared from the clabbered walls, and no work had ever been done on the garden. If it hadn't been for the vein of light around the edges of the drawn shades, he would have passed on, thinking the house deserted. The stair treads seemed to crumple under his weight, and the porch planks squealed as he crossed them. The front door opened, and he could see a dim figure holding the knob. A soft voice said, "Won't you come in?" The reception room was dimly lighted by small globes set under rose-colored shades. Adam could feel a thick carpet under his feet. He could see the shine of polished furniture and the gleam of gold picture frames. He got a quick impression of richness and order. The soft voice said, "You should have worn a raincoat. Do we know you?"
"No, you don't," said Adam. "Who sent you?"
"A man at the hotel."
Adam peered at the girl before him. She was dressed in black and wore no ornaments. Her face was sharp, pretty and sharp. He tried to think of what animal, what night prowler she reminded him. It was some secret and predatory animal. The girl said, "I'll move nearer to a lamp if you like."
"No."
She laughed.
"Sit down, over here.
You did come here for something, didn't you? If you'll tell me what you want, I'll call the proper girl." The low voice had a precise and husky power, and she picked her words as one picks flowers in a mixed garden, and took her time choosing. She made Adam seem clumsy to himself. He blurted out, "I want to see Kate."
"Miss Kate is busy now. Does she expect you?"
"No.
I can take care of you, you know.
I want to see Kate."
"Can you tell me what you want to see her about?"
"No."
The girl's voice took on the edge of a blade sharpened on a stone.
"You can't see her. She's busy. If you don't want a girl or something else, you'd better go away."
"Well, will you tell her I'm here?"
"Does she know you?"
"I don't know."
He felt his courage going. This was a remembered cold.
"I don't know. But will you tell her that Adam Trask would like to see her? She'll know then whether I know her or not."
"I see. Well, I'll tell her."
She moved silently to a door on the right and opened it. Adam heard a few muffled words, and a man looked through the door. The girl left the door open so that Adam would know he wasn't alone. On one side of the room, heavy dark portières hung over a doorway. The girl parted the deep folds and disappeared. Adam sat back in his chair. Out of the side of his eyes, he saw the man's head thrust in and then withdrawn. Kate's private room was comfort and efficiency. It didn't look at all like the room where Faye had lived. The walls were clad in saffron silk, and the drapes were apple green. It was a silken room. Deep chairs with silk upholstered cushions, lamps with silken shades, a broad bed at the far end of the room with a gleaming white satin cover on which were piled gigantic pillows. There was no picture on the wall, no photograph or personal thing of any kind. A dressing table near the bed had no bottle or vial on its ebony top, and its sheen was reflected in triple mirrors. The rug was old and deep and Chinese, an apple-green dragon on saffron. One end of the room was bedroom, the center was social, and the other end was office. Filing cabinets of golden oak, a large safe, black with gold lettering, and a roll-top desk with a green-hooded double lamp over it, a swivel chair behind it, and a straight chair beside it. Kate sat in the swivel chair behind the desk. She was still pretty. Her hair was blonde again. Her mouth was little and firm and turned up at the corners, as always. But her outlines were not sharp anywhere. Her shoulders had become plump, while her hands grew lean and wrinkled. Her cheeks were chubby, and the skin under her chin was crepe. Her breasts were still tiny, but a padding of fat protruded her stomach a little. Her hips were slender, but her legs and feet had thickened so that a bulge hung over her low shoes. And through her stockings, faintly, could be seen the wrappings of elastic bandage to support the veins. Still, she was pretty and neat. Only her hands had really aged, the palms and finger pads shining and tight, the backs wrinkled and splotched with brown. She was dressed severely in a dark dress with long sleeves, and the only contrast was billowing white lace at her wrists and throat. The work of the years had been subtle. If one had been nearby, it's probable that no change at all would have been noticed. Kate's cheeks were unlined, her eyes sharp and shallow, her nose delicate, and her lips thin and firm. The scar on her forehead was barely visible. It was covered with a powder tinted to match Kate's skin. Kate inspected a sheaf of photographs on her roll-top desk, all the same size, all taken by the same camera and bright with flash powder. And although the characters were different in each picture, there was a dreary similarity about their postures. The faces of the women were never toward the camera. Kate arranged the pictures in four piles and slipped each pile into a heavy manila envelope. When the knock came on her door, she put the envelopes in a pigeonhole of her desk. "Come in." "Oh, come in, Eva. Is he here?" The girl came to the desk before she replied. In the increased light, her face showed tight and her eyes were shiny. "It's a new one, a stranger. He says he wants to see you." "Well, he can't, Eva. You know who's coming." "I told him you couldn't see him. He said he thought he knew you." "Well, who is he, Eva?" "He's a big, gangly man, a little bit drunk. He says his name is Adam Trask." Although Kate made no movement or sound, Eva knew something had struck home. The fingers of Kate's right hand slowly curled around the palm, while the left hand crept like a lean cat toward the edge of the desk. Kate sat still as though she held her breath. Eva was jittery. Her mind went to the box in her dresser drawer where her hypodermic needle lay. Kate said at last, "Sit over there in that big chair, Eva. Just sit still a minute." When the girl didn't move, Kate whipped one word at her. "Sit." Eva cringed and went to the big chair. "Don't pick your nails," said Kate. Eva's hands separated, and each one clung to an arm of the chair. Kate stared straight ahead at the green glass shades of her desk lamp. Then she moved so suddenly that Eva jumped and her lips quivered. Kate opened the desk drawer and took out a folded paper. "Here, go to your room and fix yourself up. Don't take it all. No, I won't trust you." Kate tapped the paper and tore it in two. A little white powder spilled before she folded the ends and passed one to Eva. "Now hurry up. When you come downstairs, tell Ralph I want him in the hall close enough to hear the bell, but not the voices. Watch him to see he doesn't creep up. If he hears the bell, let him do it his own way. After that, bring Mr. Adam Trask to me. Will you be all right, Miss Kate?" Kate looked at her until she turned away. Kate called after her, "You can have the other half as soon as he goes. Now hurry up." After the door had closed, Kate opened the right-hand drawer of her desk and took out a revolver with a short barrel. She swung the cylinder sideways and looked at the cartridges, snapped it shut, and put it on her desk and laid a sheet of paper over it. She turned off one of the lights and settled back in her chair. She clasped her hands on the desk in front of her. When the knock came on the door, she called, "Come in," hardly moving her lips. Eva's eyes were wet, and she was relaxed. "Here he is," she said, and closed the door behind Adam. He glanced quickly about before he saw Kate sitting so quietly behind the desk. He stared at her, and then he moved slowly toward her. Her hands unclasped, and her right hand moved toward the paper. Her eyes, cold and expressionless, remained on his eyes. Adam saw her hair, her scar, her lips, her craping throat, her arms and shoulders and flat breasts. He sighed deeply. Kate's hands shook a little. She said, "What do you want?" Adam sat down on the straight chair beside the desk. He wanted to shout with relief, but he said,
"Nothing now. I just wanted to see you. Sam Hamilton told me you were here."
The moment he sat down, the shake went out of her hand.
"Hadn't you heard before?"
"No," he said. "I hadn't heard. It made me a little crazy at first, but now I'm all right."
Kate relaxed, and her mouth smiled, and her little teeth showed, the long canines sharp and white. She said, "You frightened me."
"Why?"
"Well, I didn't know what you'd do."
"Neither did I," said Adam.
And he continued to stare at her as though she weren't alive. "I expected you for a long time, and when you didn't come, I guess I forgot you."
"I didn't forget you," he said, "but now I can."
"What do you mean?" He laughed pleasantly.
"Now I see you, I mean. You know, I guess it was Samuel said I'd never seen you, and it's true. I remember your face, but I had never seen it. Now I can forget it."
Her lips closed and straightened, and her wide-set eyes narrowed with cruelty.
"You think you can?"
"I know I can."
She changed her manner.
"Maybe you won't have to," she said. "If you feel all right about everything, maybe we could get together."
"I don't think so," said Adam.
"You were such a fool," she said, "like a child. You didn't know what things to do with yourself. I can teach you now. You seem to be a man."
"You have taught me," he said. "It was a pretty sharp lesson."
"Would you like a drink?"
"Yes," he said.
"I can smell your breath. You've been drinking rum."
She got up and went to a cabinet for a bottle and two glasses. And when she turned back, she noticed that he was looking at her fattened ankles. Her quick rage didn't change the little smile on her lips. She carried the bottle to the round table in the middle of the room and filled the two small glasses with rum.
"Come, sit over here," she said. "It's more comfortable."
As he moved to a big chair, she saw that his eyes were on her protruding stomach. She handed him a glass, sat down, and folded her hands across her middle. He sat holding his glass, and she said, "Drink it. It's very good rum." He smiled at her, a smile she had never seen. She said, "When Eva told me you were here, I thought at first I would have you thrown out."
"I would have come back," he said. "I had to see you. Not that I mistrusted Samuel, but just to prove it to myself."
"Drink your rum," she said. He glanced at her glass.
"You don't think I'd poison you?"
She stopped and was angry that she had said it. Smiling, he still gazed at her glass. Her anger came through to her face. She picked up her glass and touched her lips to it. "Liquor makes me sick," she said. "I never drink it. It poisons me." She shut her mouth tight, and her sharp teeth bit down on her lower lip. Adam continued to smile at her. Her rage was rising beyond her control. She tossed the rum down her throat and coughed, and her eyes watered, and she wiped her tears away with the back of her hand.
"You don't trust me very much," she said. "No, I don't."
He raised his glass and drank his rum, then got up and filled both glasses.
"I will not drink any more," she said in a panic.
"You don't have to," Adam said. "I'll just finish this and go along." The biting alcohol burned in her throat, and she felt the stirring in her that frightened her.
"I'm not afraid of you or anyone else," she said, and she drank off her second glass.
"You haven't any reason to be afraid of me," said Adam. "You can forget me now. But you said you had already." He felt gloriously warm and safe, better than he had for many years.
"I came up to Sam Hamilton's funeral," he said. "That was a fine man. I'll miss him. Do you remember Kathy? He helped you with the twins."
In Kate, the liquor raged. She fought, and the strain of the fight showed on her face.
"What's the matter?" Adam asked.
"I told you it poisoned me. I told you it made me sick."
"I couldn't take the chance," he calmly said. "You shot me once. I don't know what else you've done."
"What do you mean?"
"I've heard some scandal," he said. "Just dirty scandal."
For the moment, she had forgotten her will fight against the cruising alcohol, and now she had lost the battle. The redness was up in her brain, and her fear was gone, and in its place was cruelty without caution. She snatched the bottle and filled her glass. Adam had to get up to pour his own. A feeling completely foreign to him had arisen. He was enjoying what he saw in her. He liked to see her struggling. He felt good about punishing her. But he was also watchful.
"Now I must be careful," he told himself. "Don't talk. Don't talk."
He said aloud,
"Sam Hamilton has been a good friend to me all the years. I'll miss him."
She had spilled some rum, and it moistened the corners of her mouth.
"I hated him," she said. "I would have killed him if I could."
"Why? He was kind to us."
He looked into me.
"Why not? He looked into me, too. And he helped me."
"I hate him," she said. "I'm glad he's dead."
"Might have been good if I had looked into you," Adam said.
Her lip curled.
"You are a fool," she said. "I don't hate you. You're just a weak fool."
As her tension built up, a warm calm settled on Adam.
"Sit there and grin," she cried. "You think you're free, don't you? A few drinks and you think you're a man. I could crook my little finger and you'd come back slobbering, crawling on your knees."
Her sense of power was loose and her vixen carefulness abandoned.
"I know you," she said. "I know your cowardly heart."
Adam went on smiling. He tasted his drink, and that reminded her to pour another for herself. The bottleneck chattered against her glass.
"When I was hurt, I needed you," she said.
but you were slop. And when I didn't need you anymore, you tried to stop me. Take that ugly smirk off your face.
I wonder what it is you hate so much.
You wonder, do you? Her caution was almost entirely gone. It isn't hatred. It's contempt. When I was a little girl, I knew what stupid, lying fools they were. My own mother and father, pretending goodness. And they weren't good. I knew them. I could make them do whatever I wanted. I could always make people do what I wanted. When I was half grown, I made a man kill himself. He pretended to be good, too. And all he wanted was to go to bed with me. A little girl.
But you say he killed himself. He must have been very sorry about something.
He was a fool, said Kate. I heard him come to the door and beg. I laughed all night.
Adam said, I wouldn't like to think I'd driven anybody out of the world.
You're a fool, too. I remember how they talked. Isn't she a pretty little thing? So sweet, so dainty. And no one knew me. I made them jump through hoops, and they never knew it.
Adam drained his glass. He felt remote and inspective. He thought he could see her impulses crawling like ants and could read them. The sense of deep understanding that alcohol sometimes gives was on him. He said, It doesn't matter whether you like Sam Hamilton. I found him wise. I remember he said one time that a woman who knows all about men usually knows one part very well and can't conceive the other parts. But that doesn't mean they aren't there.
He was a liar and a hypocrite, too. Kate spat out her words. That's what I hate. The liars. They're all liars. That's what it is. I love to show them up. I love to rub their noses in their own nastiness.
Adam's brows went up.
Do you mean that in the whole world there's only evil and folly?
That's exactly what I mean.
I don't believe it, Adam said quietly.
You don't believe it. You don't believe it, she mimicked him. Would you like me to prove it?
You can't, he said.
She jumped up, ran to her desk, and brought the brown envelopes to the table.
Take a look at those, she said.
I don't want to.
I'll show you anyway. She took out a photograph. Look there. That's a state senator. He thinks he's going to run for Congress. Look at his fat stomach. He's got bubs like a woman. He likes whips. That streak there, that's a whip mark. Look at the expression on his face. He's got a wife and four kids, and he's going to run for Congress.
You don't believe.
Look at this. This piece of white blubber is a councilman. This big red Swede has a ranch out near Blanco. Look here. This is a professor at Berkeley. Comes all the way down here to have the toilet splashed in his face. Professor of philosophy. And look at this. This is a minister of the gospel, a little brother of Jesus. He used to burn a house down to get what he wanted. We give it to him now another way. See that lighted match under his skinny flank?
I don't want to see these, said Adam.
Well, you have seen them, and you don't believe it. I'll have you begging to get in here. I'll have you screaming at the moon.
She tried to force her will on him, and she saw that he was detached and free. Her rage congealed to poison.
No one has ever escaped, she said softly.
Her eyes were flat and cold, but her fingernails were tearing at the upholstery of the chair, ripping and fraying the silk. Adam sighed.
If I had those pictures, and those men knew it, I wouldn't think my life was very safe, he said. I guess one of those pictures could destroy a man's whole life. Aren't you in danger?
Do you think I'm a child? She asked.
Not anymore, said Adam. I'm beginning to think you're a twisted human, or no human at all.
She smiled.
Maybe you've struck it, she said. Do you think I want to be human? Look at those pictures. I'd rather be a dog than a human. But I'm not a dog. I'm smarter than humans. Nobody can hurt me. Don't worry about danger. She waved at the filing cabinets. I have 100 beautiful pictures in there. And those men know that if anything should happen to me, anything, 100 letters, each one with a picture, would be dropped in the mail, and each letter will go where it will do the most harm. No, they won't hurt me. Adam asked,
But suppose you had an accident, or maybe a disease.
That wouldn't make any difference, she said. She leaned closer to him. I'm going to tell you a secret none of those men knows. In a few years, I'll be going away. And when I do, those envelopes will be dropped in the mail anyway. She leaned back in her chair, laughing.
Adam shivered. He looked closely at her. Her face and her laughter were childlike and innocent.
He got up and poured himself another drink, a short drink. The bottle was nearly empty.
I know what you hate. You hate something in them you can't understand. You don't hate their evil. You hate the good in them that you can't get at. I wonder what you want. What final thing?
I'll have all the money I need, she said. I'll go to New York, and I won't be old. I'm not old. I'll buy a house, a nice house in a nice neighborhood, and I'll have nice servants. And first I will find a man, if he's still alive. And very slowly, and with the greatest attention to pain, I will take his life away. If I do it well and carefully, he'll go crazy before he dies.
Adam stamped on the floor impatiently. Nonsense, he said. This isn't true. This is crazy. None of this is true. I don't believe any of it.
She said, Do you remember when you first saw me? His face darkened.
Oh, Lord, yes.
You remember my broken jaw and my split lips and my missing teeth?
I remember. I don't want to remember.
My pleasure will be to find the man who did that, she said. And after that, there will be other pleasures.
I have to go, Adam said.
She said, Don't go, dear. Don't go now, my love. My sheets are silk. I want you to feel those sheets against your skin.
You don't mean that.
Oh, I do, my love, I do. You aren't clever at love, but I can teach you. I will teach you. She stood up unsteadily and laid her hand on his arm. Her face seemed fresh and young. Adam looked down at her hand and saw it wrinkled as a pale monkey's paw. He moved away in revulsion. She saw his gesture and understood it, and her mouth hardened.
I don't understand, he said. I know, but I can't believe. I know I won't believe it in the morning. It'll be a nightmare dream. But no, it can't be a dream, no. Because I remember you are the mother of my boys. You haven't asked about them. You are the mother of my sons.
Kate put her elbows on her knees and cupped her hands under her chin so that her fingers covered her pointed ears. Her eyes were bright with triumph. Her voice was mockingly soft. A fool always leaves an opening, she said. I discovered that when I was a child. I am the mother of your sons. Your sons? I am the mother, yes. But how do you know that you are the father? Adam's mouth dropped open.
Kathy, what do you mean?
My name is Kate, she said. Listen, my darling, and remember. How many times did I let you come near enough to me to have children?
You were hurt, he said. You were terribly hurt.
Once, said Kate, just once.
The pregnancy made you ill, he protested. It was hard on you.
She smiled at him sweetly. I wasn't too hurt for your brother.
My brother?
Have you forgotten Charles? Adam laughed.
You are a devil, he said. But do you think I could believe that of my brother?
I don't care what you believe, she said.
Adam said, I don't believe it.
You will